On the other side were scraps of cloth that, beneath a layer of grime, displayed rebel starbirds and stylized beasts and smiling skulls. New Republic infantry patches, Chas guessed. Most of the trophies were damaged, chipped at the edges or scorched by particle blasts. Some of them still had the rank odor of human sweat. Kairos, what have you been doing? She'd met a Spec Force grunt once who'd claimed he'd extracted the dead stormtrooper's fingernails to ensure some post-imperial government could genetically catalog families involved in atrocities. She'd seen it as a mix of sadism and politics, but figured she might have done the same if she'd been a ground pounder. Pilots didn't collect trophies. They never got close enough. They just kept score. She peeled off one of the patches and rose from the floor. She caught a glimpse of Kairos's battered bowcaster as she ducked into the cockpit. She dropped into the co-pilot seat, shrugging off the pain of her fresh bruises. Outside, the U-Wing was ascending away from a hexagonal pattern of city blocks and entering a thin mist of clouds. They'd left the capital region and the bombardment shield behind. The unnaturally bright glow of stars was diffused by the fog, but not hidden altogether.
"You're a freak, you know," Chas said.
Kairos increased thruster power and kept her visor oriented toward the viewport. Chas studied the woman's wrappings and the dull metal of her helmet. She appeared more battered than Chas had noticed in the past, her garment as scorched and ashy as her trophies, her mask specked with rust. Chas had felt the change in Quell over the past weeks, grown almost comfortable with the straight-edged defector. But any change in Kairos came too subtly to notice. Like watching grass grow, Chas thought. She pressed the patch against the console, smoothing it with her fingers. It showed an emblem of the dead world of Alderaan orbited by a starfighter.
"One of ours, right?" she asked. "From Thanner House, maybe?"
Kairos's gloved hand flexed on the control yoke. Her head turned a fraction of a degree. It was as much acknowledgement as Chas had expected.
"What about the imp stuff? Those your kills? Ours? Someone else's? You saved them for motivation? For memorials?"
Her hand had found its way to her sidearm. She thought back to Abed Nido, where she and Kairos had slaughtered a pack of stray troopers. For all the damage Chas's acid rounds could do, Kairos had somehow done worse. The U-Wing pilot didn't react at all this time. In a human, Chas would have seen the response as arrogant. If Quell had brushed her off that way, she would have raged. But Kairos had never acted like a human. And while Nath and Will might never have considered whether species made a difference, Chas was inclined to give Kairos the benefit of the doubt. She'd been on the receiving end of too many poor assumptions. So maybe Kairos was a killer at heart, but Chas breathed in the metallic, floral scent of Kairos's gear, or her body, Chas didn't know, and made a decision. Kairos had saved her more than once, and Chas owed her a good turn.
"I won't tell anyone, obviously," Chas said.
She peeled the patch back off the console, scratching off tacky residue with her fingernails.
"You want my advice, though? You're thinking too much, carrying this stuff around. Reminders don't change the job. They just make focusing harder."
Kairos turned fully to observe Chas. Then she looked back to the viewport. Chas rose from the seat and clambered back into the main cabin.
"Look at me!"
she called as she stomped to the emergency compartment, sticking the patch against the metal somewhere close to where she'd taken it from.
"I don't dwell, and I get by fine."
That was a lie. She dwelled on many things, just never on the dead. Chapter 5. A Winding Path to Victory. 1. Erica Quell was laughing. It came naturally, though the sound was unfamiliar enough to surprise her
and her own surprise amused her further, fueling the reaction like a hyperdrive melting down. "It wasn't that funny," Karen Aiden said. He was smirking as he spoke, though Quell suspected it was at her expense. "It really wasn't," she agreed, and stifled her snicker. She flattened her affect in an instant. "You're not a funny man." Aiden arched his brow, but didn't reply. General Syndulla looked between Quell and Aiden, apparently as charmed as she was puzzled. "Let's continue," she said, and walked 2 meters around the display table and 40 kilometers west through the hollow image of Troyth's surface. The 2 weeks since beginning the march to the capital had gone well. Alphabet hadn't been grounded due to damage or mishap for more than a day. Meteor and Hale were assisting with all assignments requiring heavier firepower. There was the usual complaining from the 61st Mobile Infantry. It was increasingly apparent the unit had never fought a traditional urban ground war, and Quell had spotted the captain arguing with Syndulla more than once. But Troyth was falling to the New Republic sector by sector. Meanwhile, Quell found herself spending most of her non-flying hours with Aiden and his analysts. With Aiden, she didn't need to worry about slipping up and revealing her darkest truth. With Aiden, she could be as cynical and honest as she had the heart for. She spent more time with the intelligence officer than she did with Syndulla. Though the Twi'lek general seemed grateful for the sounding board that Quell had become. Now they were on the verge of victory. The greatest challenge was leaving room for future defeat. Syndulla took a sip of caff. 6 cups and 2 thermoses stood guard around the room. "What if we hit the command centers on the way to the Capitol building? That'll reduce the risk of the infantry being outflanked. Maybe even let us capture the governor, if we're lucky." "We're already blowing the shield generators," Quell said. "The more military infrastructure we disrupt, the less likely Shadow Wing is going to want to take the planet back." Aiden grunted. "Not that I'm arguing for it, but do we need the infrastructure if enough of the Imperial Army is left standing? When the 204th studies the situation, they'll see an opportunity to rally." "No," Quell spoke only to Aiden, leaning lightly against the table. "They're not grand strategists. Without Colonel Nerys, they'll be looking for a dramatic win achievable with a single strike. That only works if the infrastructure is there for the Troyth forces to reoccupy." "So the infrastructure stays. My big worry is putting the infantry in a kill box," Syndulla said. "Air support can only do so much. We're already paying a cost in lives to bait this trap, but total failure is a real possibility." Quell parted her lips to reply. Syndulla raised a hand, palm out, asking for silence as she wrinkled her nose and studied the map. Finally, the general nodded and drew up. "We'll have to hit the shield generators as fast as possible. Allied troops move in under the field first. Enemy emerges from hiding to intercept. We wipe out the shields. Bombers decimate the enemy before they can retreat back to the bunkers. The timing will be challenging, but I don't see a way to make it easier. Not unless someone's got a Jedi hidden away." No one spoke up. "I can dream," Syndulla said, and her smile was sadder than Quell would have expected. They spent another hour reviewing details. Aiden's team had worked up a psych profile of Governor Hastemore that did little to illuminate his strategies. Analysis of the U-Wing's reconnaissance imaging had allowed the droids to plot out multiple minimum-risk routes for the ground troops. Quell read off inventories provided by Sergeant Ragnell of starfighter munitions, though Syndulla dismissed these. "If we win here, I'm not worried about running low on torpedoes tomorrow." Quell disliked the principle, but couldn't argue. At last, General Syndulla announced that any useful discussion had ceased. "We'll close up shop and discuss outstanding issues tomorrow," she said, and began to collect the thermoses. I'd say we've got about 70 hours before the troops are in position, so no need to burn out tonight. Aiden smiled wryly. Why don't you head back? We'll save out the data. No need to keep you. Quell gave Aiden a surprised glance, but didn't comment. She stayed where she was, bent over a console, entering encryption keys for the tactical maps. I'm in no hurry, Syndulla said. Besides, I wanted to talk with Quell for a moment. If you've got concerns about the working group, Aiden began, and Quell tuned out the words as Syndulla reassured the man he wasn't being shut out. She snapped off the hollows and realized, looking between the two, that she was hoping Aiden would win the argument. Erica Quell, when did you start wanting to spend time with that man? Syndulla came out ahead, of course. Quell gathered an armful of mugs as they left the tactical center and began to walk to the galley. I've been meaning to tell you, Syndulla said. Your squadron's come a long way. Thank you, Quell said. She didn't know what else she was expected to say. I mean it. The corridors of the ship were quiet. Without the background thrum of the engines, the Lodestar seemed emptier than it truly was. You and I both remember when you couldn't get your people through a training mission without an accident. Now they're as strong a team as Meteor. Stronger than Hale Squadron since we lost the twins. Quell waited for the but. She thought of debriefings with Major Keyes, who'd rarely spared her feelings. Syndulla was fluid where he'd been solid, and the unpredictability made Quell tense. Or maybe it was the thought that Syndulla might yet realize what had happened at Necronus, or the thought that Aiden had already told her. They entered the galley, and they began returning the cups and thermoses to their places. The only advice I'm going to give you, the general smiled wryly as she spoke, is to keep an eye on them. Bringing them together was the start, but you have to keep doing the work. You noticed something wrong? Got a complaint from the ground crews about Chas joyriding in her B-wing and coming home intoxicated. Aside from the obvious, there's something going on with her. Might just be she's testing her limits. Quell wanted to ask, why wasn't I told first? But that was a complaint for the ground crew, not for the general. Syndulla kept speaking. It's the rot you don't see that does the most damage. Will, Kairos, Nath? Don't wait till the house collapses to check on them. I'll take care of it. Anything else? 70 hours, Syndulla said. After that, it's going to be a chain of crises until we know this trap failed or until Shadow Wing is done for good. They stood watching each other. Syndulla seemed to be waiting for Quell to figure out the rest. In the meantime, Quell tried. Go bond with your squadron. Maybe take the night off. Try the green one, Tenzint insisted, nudging the bottle across the table toward Chaddock. Go on.
I'm not trying it.
You're scared. You don't have to be scared.
Seriously, I'm not a puppet. You can't call me scared and make me jump into action.
Quell watched them snipe under the light of stars and the burning iris of the black hole. They sat at a long metal table in the civilian section of the spaceport, their faces warmed by heat lamps and their backs chilled by the evening breeze. Somewhere nearby, empty sun cultists were listening to holographic lectures and children were playing cards. Lark had brought them to a makeshift restaurant serving high-class neo-Coruscanti cuisine on sheets of recycled plastoid. He'd somehow met and befriended the chef, who'd taken his trade from the wealthiest region of Troyth to the refugees' tent city. Quell wasn't sure where the chef had obtained his ingredients. She had her suspicions and chose not to investigate. A choice that made her feel more like Nath Tenzint than the new Republic intelligence officer she was supposed to be. They dined on curled slivers of gutterfish encrusted with spices, bread with the texture of seafoam and the taste of salted fruit,
Spoonfuls of organic metal dust drizzled in purple and green sauces kept in oversized squeeze bottles. The portions were small, but it was unquestionably the finest meal Quell had ever eaten. She said as much to Lark, who sat beside her while they ignored the escalating argument between Tencent and Shattuck. Only Kairos hadn't joined them for the meal.
"We had plenty of food growing up," Quell said, "but it wasn't something we talked about. Flavor wasn't something we analyzed, except for my father with his brandy."
"That's the most you've ever said about your family," Lark answered.
"It's good to know."
Quell shook her head, certain that wasn't true, but wondering if the cheap wine they'd been served in tin cups wasn't having an effect.
"What about you?"
"We didn't import much from off-world, but we enjoyed our food. We..."
Tenzin's hand came down on Lark's shoulder, cutting short the younger man's thought.
"Sorry to interrupt. Think someone's looking for you."
He gestured past huddled crowds and tents, and Quell's eyes spotted a woman trekking through the dark in an infantry uniform. Her hair was braided in tight rows, and streaks of cyan paint dappled her dark skin. Quell didn't recognize her, but Lark politely excused himself.
"Who is she?"
Quell asked.
"That's Vitali," Nath said. "Been teamed up with her a few times. Don't think she saw us, but the boy deserves a good night, and they seem to get along,"
Tencent said, and Quell laughed softly. By the time their meal was finished, Lark had returned not only with Vitali, but with half a dozen other infantry soldiers. There was no more food in the restaurant's stocks, but the troops didn't seem to mind. Tencent produced an armful of Imperial rations out of nowhere. The good sort. The kind Thai pilots had traded favors for aboard the Pursuer and handed them out, calling the troops by name and pouring the last of the wine. The gathering felt less intimate than before, but that suited Quell. It allowed her to escape attention.
"Is it true we're going after the governor soon?"
one of the soldiers asked, and when Quell inclined her head enough for him to infer agreement, he swore.
"Means we actually might win this system, huh?"
"You rather not?"
Shattuck asked. The man laughed and shook his head. He was human and gray-haired and olive-skinned, with a high-pitched lilt to his voice that seemed out of place.
"Just means the next assignment comes sooner than I'd like. You know where we're going, right?"
Tenzin laughed uproariously at something occurring at the far end of the table. Lark asked,
"Where are you going?" "The captain won't admit it," the man answered, "but everyone knows Troyth is just a test run. Command is trying out tactics, seeing what works, giving us experience before they send us to the galactic capital."
"Coruscant?"
Lark said.
"Coruscant,"
the man agreed.
"Sooner or later, they're going to drop us in the thick of it. All this? Just practice."
Quell could have corrected the man. She nearly did, thanks to the wine and a sudden warm burst of poor judgment. But the working group's project was better left confidential, and she doubted he would prefer the news that Troyth was being used as bait. Besides, he might have been right. Quell didn't know what was going on in the minds of General Syndulla and her superiors. She didn't know anything about the captain of the 61st Mobile Infantry. Any reassurance she could offer would be false. Instead, she said,
"Maybe it is practice, but you'd better get it right the first time."
The table erupted in laughter and cheers and mockery. Quell downed her cup of wine and wondered if she was as flushed as she felt. They told war stories, pretending they were engaged in the natural give and take of conversation instead of one-upmanship. A man named Zab, who had just returned from Katadra, claimed that an incident there reminded him of the fall of Yordane Kor, and recited an unlikely tale of survival and a priest king's blessing. Chasna Chattuck, in reply, told a story of the Cavern Angels in the days before she'd joined Hound Squadron. An infantry woman told the story of Black Tar Cyst.
Quell remembered the battle differently, but she said nothing about having fought there as part of the 204th. Will Lark spoke of Pandem Nye. Nath Tenzint and two others swapped legends of the Battle of Hoth. Talk of Hoth became talk of Darth Vader, the dead Galactic Emperor's chief enforcer. The strangers at the table gave their own tales before Tenzint said,
"A lifetime ago, I was Imp Navy. I can tell you what I heard."
Here he paused and jutted a thumb at Quell.
"But our commanders got better."
Quell wanted to strike him. No one blinked at Tenzin's admission that he had been Imperial, however, and no one asked when she'd changed sides. They only looked at her and awaited a story.
"I never met Vader," she said.
Tenzint grinned and shook his head so only she could see. The others groaned with disapproval or urged her on.
"Give!"
Chaddock shouted and squeezed Quell's arm, nails digging into skin and Quell's squadron tattoo. She bowed her head and gave what she could. Lurid tales of Vader murdering subordinates who had failed, of Vader shooting down wingmates who got in his way during flight, of officers summoned to Vader's mysterious fortress and never permitted to return.
"One of my first captains served with Vader right after the Clone Wars and said he'd changed over the years, that he'd always been violent, but he'd matured."
"Matured?"
one of the soldiers asked.
"At the start, he'd kill you because he was frustrated. Later, he waited for you to make a mistake. Maybe a trivial mistake, but always a mistake."
"You know where he got his lightsaber?"
"I don't," Quell said. "Probably killed a Jedi for it."
Will Lark shifted uncomfortably, but no one save Quell appeared to notice. Talk of Vader became talk of his master, the fallen Emperor, and talk of the Emperor turned to ghost stories. Quell silently prayed that no one would speak of Operation Cinder, that Cinder was Emperor Palpatine's own order was a fact that remained unknown to most. And as soldiers took turns describing what they would do to the Emperor's corpse if it were recovered from the ruins of the second Death Star, Quell thought of the night she'd walked alone through the forests of the cold moon of Harkrova and been haunted by his presence.
"I wish he had survived," said a one-eyed Mon Cala who'd been lurking beside Zab most of the evening.
The socket on the scarred side of his face was as large as a fist, and Quell forced herself not to stare.
"I wish we could see him tried for every crime he ever committed, from his days as Naboo senator on. It would take a year, perhaps, but everyone in the galaxy would watch. Everyone would say, 'Never again shall such an empire rise.' And when they executed him at last, every Imperial who followed him would fear the justice of the New Republic."
Vitali raised her wine cup with a grin before spitting on the ground.
"If they tried him first, every Imperial who followed would have a defense. I wasn't as bad as that guy." "Executions never brought anyone justice," someone else said,
and Quell stared past Lark's shoulder into the crowds of refugees milling about in the starlight or heading to their tents. The conversation fractured, one half of the gathering arguing over the ethics of capital punishment, while the other half offered ill-informed tactical speculation about the defenses of the Anoa'it sector and the iron blockade there.
"Come on,"
Nath Tenzin said, and practically lifted Quell from her seat one-handed.
"Let the dirt stompers have the table. We've all got enough wine in us to enjoy the night."
She would have had an excuse if she'd been drunk. But only Chaddock had imbibed enough wine to be more than loose, and Quell knew she was responsible for her choices as they made their way into the spaceport tram station and boarded one of the maintenance cars. Unlike the rest of the network, they were self-powered and fully functional.
"We'll get shot down, and then what?"
Quell asked as Tenzint withdrew a code cylinder and activated the auto-navigation. "It goes half a click outside the port," Lark said patiently. If there are enemy troops targeting us this close in, we'd be doing the general a favor luring them out,
Chaddock said much too loudly, laughing as she did. She flung her arms around Quell's shoulders for balance as the tram car lifted out of its moorings and hummed along an ascending mini-line. The four of them rode together, and Quell tried to put aside questions like, why are we doing this tonight? Why am I here? What if an alert goes out? And focus instead on the view and Chaddock's warm, muscular arms against her. Lark and Tenzin were pointing out something below them. Quell didn't try to see what. She watched the lights of the camp grow smaller until they reflected the brightness of the starry sky. She watched the titanic cityscape become as unreal as a silhouette in the night, saved from total obliteration by scattered lanterns and distant towers blazing like distant beacons, detached from the dormant power grid. Quell felt what she could not see, the antiquity of the world, the billions of lives lived across hundreds of years, the masses still teeming in the darkness, and the utter weight of a world converted into a labyrinth of civilizations extending through time and space. Parts of her brain sparked like a loose electrical conduit, attempting to calculate the tonnage of Troth's structures as a means to understand its scale. She didn't know how to begin. She leaned against Chasna Chaddock and heard conversation beside her, but she no longer understood the words. It was a glorious evening. It wasn't yet midnight when they parted ways. Lark said he needed to check on his ship before bed. Tenzin winked and headed back into the refugee camp. Quell escorted Chaddock back to the Lodestar, shivering in the night's chill. The Thelan woman stumbled all the way through the spaceport and into the battleship's halls, shrugging off Quell's offers of help and proceeding into a turbolift with a slurred, I do this every night. Quell would have followed up. The notion raised alarms and reminded her of Syndulla's concerns, if she hadn't heard the footsteps behind her. She turned. Standing in the dim light of the corridor was Kairos. Quell stiffened as if she'd been caught. Kairos hadn't been with them through the evening, hadn't lowered her guard, and now she watched Quell with her softly glowing visor as if she were ready to rebuke Quell for forgetting herself. Quell opened her mouth and said nothing. She breathed in the floral scent of the strange woman. Kairos took three steps until she was half a meter from Quell. Each footfall rang like a gong on the metal deck. Quell noted the tears in the woman's cloak, the rip in the leather of her left glove, which revealed only more fabric beneath. The last time she'd been so close to Kairos, the woman had thrown her onto the floor of an airless cargo bay and pulled away Quell's oxygen mask. Kairos had been steady then, implacable, and Quell still didn't fully understand why the woman had spared her. Kairos was not steady now, nor implacable. She was trembling. A voice, low and wet and guttural, made sounds that Quell took full seconds to register as words.
They fall for us, so we may purge the shadow. The mission must succeed.
As if released from a spell, Kairos's shoulders slumped and she spun away, marching back the way she'd come. Chasna Chaddock was snoring in Quell's bunk when Quell finally made it to her billet, one of the Thelan's legs dangling off the edge and a blanket pulled halfway over her face. The unreality of Quell's encounter with Kairos dissipated like a dream. She had to hold back a laugh. She couldn't imagine why Chaddock was there. Once it might have shaken Quell, back when she'd first met the younger woman, when, she could admit it now, she'd felt a juvenile attraction crawling under her skin. She'd felt jealousy watching Chaddock and Lark on the cold moon of Harkrova.
That crush was gone now. The intensity burned away in the aftermath of Pandem Nye. Quell lowered herself to the floor, tugging over a corner of Chaddock's blanket to use as a pillow. As she drifted into sleep, she thought about what Kairos had said. She thought of the masked woman flying above the Thanner House Lake, hugging the water as she rescued soldiers in the face of certain death. She thought of Kairos killing with cannons and gloved hands. There was meaning to be found in those half-cogent images, but by morning, Quell had forgotten it all. Chapter 6, A Straight Path to Tragedy. 1.
Bombers in position. Waiting for the fun to start,
Nath Tenzant said into his calm, though it struck him as he said it that this was the least fun he'd had in weeks. He called out his coordinates to the Lodestar, leaning back as the Y-Wing rumbled around him.
How about you, Chas? You know I'm in position. You can see me floating to starboard,
she answered.
I'm the speck that doesn't handle well in wind.
Nath's display blinked and he read T5's commentary. His astromech droid had a foul imagination. He grinned and refrained from sharing the message for the sake of the flight control officer.
Just let us know when you've got work for us. We'll keep our eyes on the shield,
he said, and ceased transmitting to the ground. By now, Will and Quell were streaking toward the capital, low enough to slip below the energy shield and make for the generators. Until the shield was down, though, there wasn't much for Nath or Chas or Hale Squadron to do. Their assault craft didn't have the speed or agility to follow the A-Wing and X-Wing, and the enemy wasn't stupid enough to send forces out from cover. So they waited.
You picking your songs?
Nath asked. He heard the petulance in Chess's voice.
How long do you think it takes me? So you're not busy then? I've got a pack of cards. Seriously? Sure. You got a week's pay to bet? Sure,
Nath repeated. His week's pay wasn't the same as Chess's, but she didn't need to know that. Cairn Aiden was still lining Nath's pockets, as he had been since the founding of the working group. Originally, Aiden had treated Nath as his personal agent, offering regular deposits of credits in return for the occasional side job. Now that Aiden had a whole division working for him, both men understood the new deal without speaking openly of it. Aiden's payments were meant to keep Nath silent as much as keep him on the squadron. Nath had learned things about Erica Quell that Aiden was choosing to keep quiet. Nath was fine with that. He could use the extra cash. Nath pulled a deck from under his seat. He and Chas played a slow, awkward hand of full-open sabacc, occasionally pausing when someone announced progress on the ground.
What do you say about a side wager?
He asked.
Suppose the governor's got a surprise waiting for us down there.
Chas laughed loud enough for the cockpit speaker to crackle.
Course he does. No bet.
Nath shrugged and scratched beneath his helmet's chin strap. Chas wasn't the brightest member of the squadron, but she wasn't an idiot.
What's your prediction for the whole battle? My prediction is that Will and Quell fly into a firestorm. They scrape by, take out the shield generators anyway, and by the time we get down there, it's all easy flying. Still a meat grinder for the ground troops, obviously. Obviously.
Nath liked the troops of the 61st, but he'd learned before ever joining the military that infantry didn't survive long. It was why he'd picked the Navy instead of the Army.
Guess in a few hours, the planet will be ours. Maybe Quell or Aiden will share their plans for us then.
He noticed the uncertainty in her silence, even before her awkward reply.
Right.
Now that's interesting.
You figure they'll keep holding back?
He asked. It wasn't a question he especially cared about,
but it was a probe fired off into the night.
Probably,
Chas said. Nath turned the conversation over in his head and grinned.
You don't want to see Shadowwing again, do you?
Chas swore. Nath silenced her transmission and replied to a status update from the ground before he caught the end of her signal.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Sure I do,
he said.
Don't worry about it. Truth is, I don't think Will much wants to run into them again either.
He tell you that?
Will's a good kid. He'll grow into a half-decent commander if he gets the chance. But he isn't exactly hard to read.
That got a snort from Chas, though she didn't say a word. Nath considered sharing what Will had told him, but decided to keep the boy's confidence. They'd spent an evening together dancing around the subject, Will expressing his gentle frustration with the Troyth operation until it became obvious he was worried about another disaster like Pandem Nye, worried about the price of another victory. But Nath assumed that sheer terror played a role in Will's lack of enthusiasm, too. Will wasn't a coward, but he was only human. If he didn't want to face Shadowwing again, of course he'd justify it as worry over the plan. He wondered if he could get Chas to come clean. She was the last squad member he'd expected to have reservations, even if she'd gotten past her death wish. She sure as sin hadn't lost her grudge against Shadowwing. Before he could say anything, she spoke again.
What about you?
He considered the question before saying,
I got my revenge, and those bastards nearly killed me twice. I'm not looking forward to it either.
He left out the parts she didn't need to hear. That the fun was getting a pile of credits for very little work as the New Republic claimed its territory. That he was finding a lot of pleasure in playing air support to troops who would shout his name and drink with him and make a fuss when he landed. Taking the capital was a risk. Trapping Shadowwing was going to be work.
Well,
Chas said,
maybe we'll screw this mission up and we won't have to worry about it.
Nath would have answered, but another transmission came through first. People were dying far below. The battle had started. 2. Over 2 decades earlier, following the ascension of Galactic Emperor Palpatine, Troyth's capital had been relocated from its 1,000-year home in the gloried Chalice District to the Troyth Planetary Defense Center. Before the Empire, the TPDC's role had been symbolic. Private military companies had battled separatist incursions during the Clone Wars, while the TPDC's interplanetary missile batteries, stadium-sized ion cannons, and massive infantry barracks had sat abandoned. Yet in an effort to restore planetary pride, Troyth's first Imperial governor had raised or converted the obsolete weaponry to build bureaucratic processing centers and state-of-the-art broadcast facilities. Tram lines now ran between missile silos turned luxury apartment complexes. Modern turbolasers stood surrounded by bronze statues of forgotten Troyth war heroes, and the colossal shield generators that rendered an eighth of a continent invincible rose from army parade grounds between starkly glittering towers. Even under the dark of the Cerberon skies, Erica Quell was grateful for the polarized visor of her flight helmet as she navigated the TPDC. Beams of light lanced the air, originating from point defense mounts and raking the skies in 5-second bursts. The beams that failed to find a starfighter, and 2 had disintegrated Meteor Squadron X-Wings already, either ripped through the tallest structures or splashed against the underside of the planetary shields, causing sparks and fire to rain down. TIE Strikers, all spherical cockpit pods and blade-like wings built for atmospheric combat, flew in the beam's wake, the last of the Governor's Air Force. Quell swung her X-Wing to and fro, fingers stiff around her control yoke, and boots alternating pressure on her rudder pedals. She ignored the stream of complaints scrolling down her display from CB9. The astromech was struggling to keep the ship stable, adjusting thruster output and repulsor power multiple times per second. Keep it stable or we both die, Quell thought. She felt D6L's memory chip on its necklace chain, cold against the sweat on her throat.
Close strike foils,
she said. Her scanner blazed in warning as a missile, surface launched or from an enemy fighter she couldn't determine, swept toward her. Blood rushed to her head as she rolled the X-wing and skimmed the outer frame of a tower.
See if we can buy more maneuverability.
The sound of an explosion behind her, powerful enough to rock her ship, reassured her that she'd evaded the missile.
With S-foils closed, you've got no weapons,
a voice protested. Quell recognized the speaker as Meteor Leader and resisted snapping back before he continued.
We'll do our best to cover you. Understood,
Quell said, and tried to find Will Lark on her scanner. Lark was playing scout. His A-wing was faster than anything else in the air. As death pierced the sky from below and fell from above, he'd looped around towers and streaked down streets and tunnels, searching for a path to the shield generator that the X-Wings could follow. Quell found his blip half a kilometer ahead, no more than 10 meters above ground. She felt her ship's servos whir and the strike foils lock closed as she called,
Where to? They mounted missile platforms on the tram lines,
Lark returned. His voice was strained.
Trace my path exactly.
CB9 sent flight paths to her console. She didn't question them. She dived. Gleaming metal blurred around her before she leveled out above an electrified transport track built for loads too bulky for trams. Current arced to violently interact with her shields, causing the energy globe to burn so bright she could see nothing beyond her canopy. In that moment, as she wrestled with her controls, using instruments to navigate, she was no longer on Troyth, but skimming the surface of Yethra, the horrifying brightness of the sun reflecting off ice sheets and leaving her blind to the world. She wasn't sure if it was Lark's voice or Zion's guiding her, warning her of enemies swooping in pursuit. She watched on her scanner as Major Keyes or Meteor Squadron sent the scorched metal chunks of her opponents crashing around her. It didn't matter. She knew her mission. She barely knew who she was, but she knew her mission.
Approaching the generator now,
Lark said. Reality reformed around her as she sped down the track.
Ground forces have engaged the foe,
General Syndulla's voice announced.
Take those shields down and take them down fast.
Three. Will Lark felt his fighter lurch as he launched every missile he had. The parade grounds were at street level, but they seemed like the depths of a plunging abyss, dwarfed by towers on all sides and awash in gloom. Particle bolts streamed from turret emplacements around the perimeter, charging the darkness with crimson lightning. But the turrets were slow to rotate, and their deadly output was simple to elude. The 20-meter discs of the shield generators were caked in dirt and rust, crude in comparison with the sleek surrounding structures. The vast energy they emitted was invisible to a human eye. Will saw only the first impact. The concussion missile struck between the discs and flashed, but he was already pulling up before the second missile hit home. Far above, he could see the faint, shimmering opacity of the deflector field. His spine dug into his seat. His scanners showed ties converging on all sides. His missiles hadn't sufficed. If he was going to escape, if he was going to survive, it would be because Quell followed him and finished the job. If he died, he would die dashing his ship and his body against the deflector field they failed to destroy. It's okay, he breathed, with what little oxygen his lungs could find. It's okay.
In position,
Quell said, and Will closed his eyes and waited. 4.
Bombers, go! Go!
General Syndulla's voice came through the comm, sudden enough to startle Chas. She straightened in her seat, checked her angle, and ignited her thrusters even before Nath called.
You ready?
Sure,
Chas said.
So long as no one tries to shoot me, I'll be just fine.
How's the rest of our squadron doing?
Nath asked. The B-wing bounced as Chas adjusted its gyroscopics. She'd kept the cross upright while holding position against the wind. But in flight, she was better off horizontal and began a long, spiraling descent through the cloud cover toward the capital. Nath and the Y-wings of Hale Squadron were behind her now, but according to the flight plan, they'd overtake her once they descended below shield altitude. She was wondering if something had gone wrong when Quell's voice said,
Lark and I are intact and on our way to escort you. Kairos is giving cover to the ground teams. Great,
Chas said.
We'll try not to blow her to bits.
When the cloud cover ripped away and the city came into view, Chas tapped a button. The rapid patter of a Lolitian politifolk singer filled the cockpit. The Y-wings followed her, and she swayed with the breeze and the song, and the first proton torpedoes and laser-guided bombs dropped toward pre-assigned coordinates like the two bright stars of Cerberon rattling loose from the sky. Soon, Chas would be close enough to see the devastation. Soon, she'd be picking targets and evading fire while trying not to murder her own side's ground troops. She could forget the conversation with Nath. He'd sneered, You don't want to see Shadow Wing again, do you? But he was wrong about that. Shadow Wing didn't frighten her so much as what came after Shadow Wing. The B-Wing leapt as a proton bomb ejected from its launcher. For now, she could do the things she was best at. The only thing she was made for. Five. General Hera Syndulla of the New Republic stood in the tactical center of the Lodestar and observed as glowing dots on a screen shaped the fate of a planet. She listened to the chatter of pilots and ground troops, heard triumphant cries and anxious voices, and watched her subordinates clutch their headsets and snap replies. She tried to appear strong and confident and compassionate, all to bait a trap. Even if they won, she wouldn't know if it was worth it until Shadow Wing arrived, until another battle had been fought. Lodestar is in position, her aide said as he drew up to her side. By the expression on his face, she could have believed Stormvane hadn't said the words in a dozen battles before. His unwillingness to become jaded was why she kept him on staff. Even without the shield, there's not much room to descend, but we'll pick off any ties if they get close. Thank you, she said. What about the video feed? Some jamming activity, Stormvane said, but it should be ready now. Pixelated holo footage from a soldier's helmet cam showed a telescope's view of chaos. Two close glimpses of a grand tapestry of destruction. Fires burned, stormtroopers squatted behind barricades made of piled speeders. The frame of a scout walker slumped against a building. Streaks in the sky could have been starfighter cannons or torpedoes. Hera should have been on the ground. Instead, she'd chosen to remain at a remove to coordinate forces too professional, too well organized to truly need a general overseeing them from orbit. Rotate the comm channels, she said. I want to know what they're thinking. She pieced together the state of the battle from audio fragments. Meteor Squadron was maneuvering to drive away TIE strikers and thwart enemy attempts to provide air support. She flinched as Meteor 2 called for assistance and sighed in relief when his brother eliminated their pursuers. Infantry squads were calling in coordinates to Hale Squadron. Glowing dots faded from her screens as walkers and tanks were annihilated by proton bombs. She lingered on the feed from Alphabet. She recognized Will Lark's distress as he hissed,
If this goes on, there won't be anything left of the district.
This is the plan,
Quell said.
This is the only way we win.
Hera shook her head briskly.
She'd grown to like the Alphabet pilots over the past months, though she didn't know them well. She'd been proud to see Quell take command and apply her skills as a tactician. But part of her, a very small part, one she wasn't thrilled with, wished they'd never brought their war with the 204th to her unit. She'd approved Aiden and Quell's plan because it was a good one. That didn't mean she liked it. "What's going on there?" she asked as multiple dots on the tactical screen crept in sync away from the edges of the district, back toward the midpoint. Stormvane huddled beside a comm officer. The two whispered urgently as Hera examined the maps. "The governor's ordered a retreat," Stormvane said after a moment. "Enemy ground teams are withdrawing toward the logistics center. Control for communications, data flow, civilian power grid. The Tri-Central Complex, officially." She recognized the name. She was puzzled, nonetheless. Why not the governor's mansion or one of the military stations? Tri-Central doesn't have much in the way of defenses, does it? "It's accessible via two major throughways under enemy control. It could just be a convenience, the easiest spot to regroup." Hera started to swear, caught herself, and squared her shoulders. She stepped to one of the comm stations and keyed in a frequency override. "General Syndulla to all forces. We have to cut off their retreat. Do not let the enemy near the Tri-Central Complex." A flurry of affirmative responses followed. A familiar, husky voice asked over the link,
"What's happening, General?"
"Lieutenant Quell, so far as we can determine, whoever's commanding their forces just made a very stupid decision, or a very smart one." She summarized what they'd seen and continued. "Either way, we can't afford to let them consolidate forces there."
"Understood," Quell said.
Hera expected she did understand. The battle plan was Quell's as much as Hera's own. She watched the dots on the map. Very soon, she would have a decision to make, but she feared it would be no decision at all. Six. Quell heard General Syndulla order the bombers to break off as enemy ground forces approached the complex. She immediately recognized the reasoning. Predicting the consequences took her a moment longer. Tri-Center wasn't a military installation, but the facility was essential to the planet's infrastructure network. Holding it wouldn't win the war, and losing it wouldn't bring about defeat. Yet, if Tri-Center was reduced to ruins by the bombs and torpedoes of New Republic starfighters, Troyth would be left in disarray for months to come. No outside force would care to reclaim the planet for the Empire. Therefore, Tri-Center had to be preserved, or else the working group's efforts to bait the trap, to lure Shadow Wing into attacking Troyth, would fail. Quell wasn't prepared to fail. She thought of all this as she escorted Shattuck's assault craft out of the combat zone, pursued half-heartedly by a TIE striker barely able to stay aloft. She split her attention between her flight and the feeds blinking on her display, indicators of ground troop positions and enemy progress. With the bombers pulling back, the New Republic infantry would be left without support. Tri-Center wasn't well fortified, but it didn't need to be. Allied and enemy ground forces were evenly matched, and a clash inside the complex would guarantee a bloodbath. Alternatively, if the New Republic infantry retreated, it would position the governor, or whoever survived to take command, to resecure the region and collapse the narrow corridor Syndulla's forces had been establishing from the spaceport to the capital. Those were the options. Hundreds of dead New Republic troops, or weeks, months of progress lost in the campaign to take Troyth and trap Shadow Wing. Quell knew what she would choose. She knew what General Syndulla would choose, too.
CB-9,
she said.
"I want to hear what the squads are saying."
The droid patched her into the infantry frequencies. Only a handful of squads were in position to intercept the enemy approaching Tri-Center, and they were sorely pressed. Barely a dozen people were attempting to blockade the entrance against hundreds of stormtroopers and army regulars. The Imperial walkers and tanks, at least, had largely been destroyed or abandoned.
but even at a choke point, the New Republic wouldn't hold out long.
What's the word, General?
The infantry captain called.
I can't stop them. I can buy you another minute, maybe five with a miracle.
Quell had met the captain, though she couldn't recall his name. He'd been younger than she'd expected, aware of the peculiarities of the campaign, and insistent that Syndulla understand the cost in lives, but never refusing an objective. Never asking why they were taking the capital in such a manner. She expected he would let his people die if ordered to do so. Quell spoke, though she knew doing so was improper.
Would 5 minutes be enough to bring your people in from the rear? Flank the enemy, push them away from Tri-Center?
No,
the captain said.
Get them out of there, Captain, however you think best,
Syndulla said.
I'm sorry, Quell.
Quell was protesting, but she couldn't hear herself. She saw the work she'd done, the sacrifices on the ground, the last hope of finding Shadow Wing burning away in the fire of the battle. There would be no second chance. Everything she had built with Aiden required that the trap be set now, not in a week or a month. Her heart rate spiked. The air in the cockpit seemed thin. Then a new voice broke into the comm frequency. She didn't recognize the speaker, one of the infantry troops.
Captain, got a U-Wing coming in fast and taking a lot of damage. If that's our evac, not sure we can make it back out.
This, too, Quell immediately understood. Kairos. She pressed a rudder pedal hard, leaned into the turn and the pressures on her body, and made for the Tri-Center complex. Seven. There were words Kairos did not understand. Even after years of exposure, she struggled to comprehend the intricacies of the language so demeaningly called Galactic Basic. But words were not always a barrier to understanding, and she knew what was occurring on the battlefield. She knew why the ships and soldiers pulled back. She would not join them. A single broad boulevard led to the Tri-Center complex, joined by narrower tributaries. A horde of white-clad troopers pushed toward the front entrance, toward the once transparent metal facade towering like a cliff wall, pockmarked and ash-smeared into opacity, where particle bolts had left their mark. Where the eternal gloom of Cerberon enveloped the street, the interior atrium blazed with light, illuminating the trapped rebel soldiers who attempted to repel the invasion. Perhaps they had a means to escape, a way out of the complex. She swept in low above the boulevard, flickering particle lances from the horde shattering against her shields. Her vessel trembled as the electromagnetic field churned and coruscated. Her ship, the hatchling, within her deflector's invisible shell. She fired her cannons into the crowd, sending burning bodies flying into packs of survivors. There were too many for her to miss, even as they scattered. Perhaps her allies did not need Kairos to save them. Perhaps she acted for her own sake. She fumbled with her vessel's controls through ungainly gloves, smelling the rotting odor of her twisted body trapped inside her mask. She could not scent the smoke or charred corpses, though she could imagine both with perfect clarity. She angled her ship 10 degrees upward, exposing aft and underside to the continuing fire of the enemy and making for the transparent metal facade of the complex. She diverted all power from her forward deflectors and into her killing cannons, an act of technical wizardry that possessed no deeper meaning, no resonance in the true world, yet proved effective for her needs. Cannons flashed. The howl of torn metal resonated through her organs. Somehow she could taste the tang of iron. And she entered the atrium through the newly created gap in the wall, shifting from thrusters to repulsors, turning 90 degrees and floating 10 meters above the startled New Republic soldiers. Kairos had been at war with herself, her spirit sundered. She'd often thought of leaving her people, leaving the defector, leaving Aiden. She would not leave Aiden.
Half sheltered by the fragmented wall of the atrium, Kairos accepted the blow of an incoming rocket against her flank. The vessel heaved and listed to one side. She saw in her console the damage to thrusters and repulsors, but she was still aloft. She gently adjusted a lever and climbed out of her seat, retreating to the main cabin. With the touch of a button, she opened the loading door and, stepping behind the turret gun, fired into the horde once again. She understood that Aiden and the defector sought to ensnare their foe in a trap. She'd comprehended those words well after Aiden had taken her aside and explained each step. The butchers of Necronus and Pandemni and so many other worlds did not deserve to escape justice. Nor did the beast of Troyth, who called himself Governor, who unleashed monsters against his enemies, deserve to escape punishment. So she had accepted the strategy of a man wiser than she and agreed to the price in blood. She raked the stream of the turret through the gap in the wall and across the boulevard, tearing apart stormtroopers and black-clad troops, their faces sweaty and screaming. She could hear the battle clearly now, the shouts and the sizzle of bolts and the crackle of flames. As her foes returned fire and the deck began to shake, she thought that horde seemed smaller. Since their time on Troyth had begun, she had slaughtered and allowed noble warriors to be slaughtered. In her commitment to vengeance, to the scouring of her foes, she had accepted the sacrifice of the soldiers she was expected to preserve. She had agreed to the price. She would not, could not, turn away now. The deck jumped once to warn her that the ship was failing. She leapt from the turret to seize the crew seats as repulsors died and the U-Wing dropped to the atrium floor. She heard only a cacophonous roar and saw nothing. Her vision was obliterated by the stresses of gravity and bulkheads. And when sight returned, her body was suffused with pain. Motion was rewarded with surges of agony. But she had suffered worse, and she scaled the wreckage of the askew cabin to retrieve her weapon. She could not turn away. Never turn away. Not after all that had happened. She didn't know what had become of the New Republic soldiers. She lodged her bowcaster against her shoulder and gurgled instead of screamed as it kicked back against her with every shot fired. The crash of the U-Wing had left the atrium thick with smoke and flame, and the clouds glowed like the clouds of Pandemni, exquisitely scarlet, as they soaked up the colors of particle bolts streaming toward her. She felt air against her skin. Her forearm wrappings were scorched. She had broken her last vow. She fired into the smoke. She fired at the stormtroopers who hurled themselves toward her, piled body upon body, few in the grand tale of it all, few compared to those she'd killed in the past and those soldiers she'd failed to save, and kept on firing until she could no longer feel, could no longer stand. She heard cannon fire outside the complex, but she could not raise her head to see. She heard the calls of rebel soldiers still alive. The last thing Kairos saw was the beautiful face of Erica Quell, the defector, the traitor, looking down at her. Eight. Cairn Aiden could hear the reports through the wall, but he steadfastly ignored them. His staff was tracking every soldier's death, every meter gained by the New Republic infantry, as if there were something they could do to affect the outcome of the battle from their stations in the tram tower. As if the fight for the capital were part of their duties instead of a distraction. Aiden remembered a summer in the offices of the IGBC Financial Review when his colleagues had made a daily habit of ceasing conversation one by one and tuning their consoles to the season's ongoing Smash Ball tournament. Aiden had possessed neither interest in Smash Ball nor any local pride in Munalint's team, having only transferred there for the work. He'd found the practice relentlessly irritating. And though his time on Munalinst seemed like a half-forgotten dream, and he had much at stake in the battle at the capital, he was determined to make better use of his time than his colleagues past and present. After all, it wouldn't be long before Shadow Wing arrived in system. He intended to be fully prepared. He told himself this even as his antenna palps stood rigid. The noise of comm chatter outside his office resonated in his skull. He ignored the reports, yet he still listened. What would Ito say, seeing you distracted? He wondered, and snatched a data pad from his stack to review. He buried himself in news of Vanguard Squadron's operations in the Bormia sector, taking diligent notes on the impact to Cerberon's defense capabilities until his console pinged and notified him he was receiving a direct transmission. The codes were military, but the sender was unidentified. He activated his comm and waited.
Aiden,
Erica Quell said. He hadn't expected to hear from her until hours after the battle. They'd been getting on better lately, though. She seemed calmer, and she had become more communicative. He wondered on occasion if she was simply manipulating him. I'm here. What's going on?
Kairos is hurt,
she said, her tone flat.
We're evacing now. I'm not sure of her condition. I thought you'd want to know.
Send coordinates to my team, he said, and closed the channel as he stood. He paused long enough to grab his comlink, made it out of his office and halfway to the turbo lift before it occurred to him to return for his coat, then forged ahead anyway. He ignored the stares from Nasha Gravis and the rest of his staff. They could supervise themselves for an hour. He tried to snuff the anxiety in his chest as he formulated a plan. If her injuries were bad enough, they'd take her to the spaceport, but only if she could survive the trip. Otherwise, they'd move her to a field station, and he'd need a shuttle to get there. He tried to remember who was still available to fly him, who hadn't gone to the capital to fight, and ran through a mental list of names as he stepped out into the spaceport proper. Had he sent Kairos to die? It had never occurred to him that Kairos could die. If she did die. Time became a blur. He spoke to Nasha through his comlink. He made arrangements for an airspeeder. He kept walking alongside the refugee settlement and out to the tarmac where a pilot met him. 30 minutes later, he was at a field site, and only then did he find the courage to alert ITO. The droid would want to know, even if Aiden didn't want to talk to him. It had been the three of them in the camp long ago. Aiden owed and trusted Kairos, and she owed and trusted him. The medical evac point was nothing more than a few oversized tents erected around a makeshift landing pad outside the flooded remains of the Thanner House district. Aiden doubted anyone present, organic or droid, had the proficiency to treat Kairos. But he would put in the call anyway. He'd tell ITO to unlock her files, to decrypt and declassify everything he had about Kairos' anatomy. He expected they'd argue about it, but ITO would obey an order if it was given. He'd worry about Kairos' reaction later. Yes, she trusted him. She would expect him to keep her secrets, but he owed her. He was activating his comlink, breathing in the stink of polluted water when someone behind him spoke his name. What? Aiden asked, not turning around. There was no answer but the muzzle of a blaster against his scalp, and electrical crackle, and the sound of his own breath expelled from his lungs. Chapter 7. Schemes and Dreams. 1. He had chosen the timing carefully, waiting for a moment when the value of his guidance had become clear. Soren Keyes didn't think of himself as a man proficient at politics, nor one who enjoyed them, but he knew when he was liked and when he was loathed. Only a fool proposed a new enterprise when he was loathed. Thus, the morning after the attack on Perosa 7, Soren called the leadership of the 204th into conference. It had been barely 6 hours since Squadrons 2, 3, and 4 had swarmed the supply port, first annihilating every docked ship
and then cracking open the station itself, suffocating the inhabitants and blasting open the cargo bays so that the Edict's tractor beam might retrieve whatever bounty the crew could lock onto. It was an act of piracy more than an act of war, but the Peroza 7 outpost had once supplied the Empire and now aided the enemy. Before Endor, the Rebel Alliance had struck ports with less justification. Word was that the outpost had been operated by the same family of Parwans for generations, a forest of over 70 of the fungal creatures left to drift in vacuum. The galaxy was a touch less wondrous without them. The squadron commanders and senior staff of the Edict and Aerie sat at the Edict conference table where Soren sipped a cup of tea, a blend he didn't recognize, one of the few worthwhile spoils from the attack, and waited for their attention. "We have an opportunity," he finally said, "a chance to do more than simply restock, rebuild, and survive another month. I'd like to put forth a proposal." The words carried risk. The phrasing was a concession to his status as advisor, yet there was no humility in his tone. He might well incite the commanders against him. "The deep core system of Cerberon has been hard-pressed in recent months," he went on. "Once an Imperial stronghold, its planets are rapidly falling into Rebel hands, and we have received a plea for aid. The message was corrupted, but it appeared to be from allies of Governor Hastemore. It contained details of the enemy presence in system, as well as the remaining Imperial holdouts. Such distress signals have not been infrequent." He raised a hand to forestall questions that didn't come. "But all of them so far have been from parties too distant or desperate to be worth attending." Now he did wait. It was Major Rassus who said, "I've seen the distress calls. I've never pressed to pursue them. There's little we can do for the Empire's gangrenous limbs. So tell us, what makes this call different?" "Specifics," Soren said, "and a plan of action." He tapped the control panel on the conference table. Lights dimmed and a hologram shimmered into being, displaying the layout and orbital paths of the Cerberon system. A tangled knot of satellites and planets and asteroids whipped around the mass of a black hole. A blinking halo accented a dot labeled Troyth. "The sender suggested an unusual approach to the capital, a planet heavily shielded and under guard by enemy naval forces. The system's orbital dynamics are, as you can see, extraordinarily complex. The local government expended significant resources studying and modeling the effects of the black hole. Wartime activity caused additional disruption in the debris field, which in turn resulted in minor collisions between uninhabited planetoids." He paused and smiled long enough to make a show of humility. "I'm quoting the reports now. Astrophysics isn't my field, but the Edict's main computer double-checked the math." Lieutenant Cedia raised a single finger. Soren had expected her to challenge him again at some point, had invited her to the conference anticipating it, despite her rank, though now seemed an unusual time to do so. He acknowledged her with a glance and a nod.
"I spent a year in the astronomy department at the Institute for Quantitative Studies at Bothawi."
Not a